Hey, everybody, just a quick word before we get started with this week's episode. What better gift to get the Air Raid fan in your life but two t-shirts and a poster from the Air Raid podcast? That's right. Go to air-raid.net, follow the instructions on the merch tab, and purchase a couple for your lover or your friend. It's a great gift. Also, you can donate to the show, $5, $10, whatever, $100, $100 million, to help us out, get some more equipment that we need here in Dining Room Studios. All right, happy holidays, everybody. Enjoy. Well, hello and welcome, everyone.
Oh, yeah, I like this idea.
Welcome to the Air Raid Podcast.
Okay.
This is episode 127.
Hail to the king, baby.
In what is now officially considered a long and drawn-out series.
It's gonna hurt a lot of it.
I am your host, Aaron Roden.
Fighter of the night, man.
And this, of course, is the show where we drop bombs of awesome straight into your ear holes. Once a week. Hey, we've got a great show for you this week. Comedian Hari Kondabolu is going to be joining us shortly. I had a great talk with this guy. I was a little nervous when we were set out to meet and to have this little chat because like I've said before, he's an intelligent person. And I don't know. I guess I just don't see myself as a very intelligent person. And I get nervous trying to keep up with somebody like that. And that definitely comes through in this conversation that we're going to bestow on you. So yeah, boy, we'll get back into that in just a second. First, it's been a weekend. It's definitely been a weekend. Some real sad news on Friday, of course. I'm sure everybody has heard about it by now. The shootings in Connecticut, Newtown, Connecticut, at the elementary school. Just such a sad, sad thing. And I could not wait on Friday just to get home and hug my daughter and just hold her in my arms. And it was a sweet embrace when I got home. But it's a weird thing when you're a parent, and all of a sudden you've got all these feelings for a small, helpless individual, and you can definitely start to relate to other parents that are going through such trauma, at that point in their lives. Oh man, just such a terrible story. But I don't want to get too bogged down in that. So, as I've talked about before on this show, let's change the subject, shall we? Let's change the subject. As I've talked about before many times, I have the tendency to, for short, angry outbursts. And last night, my parents came over, and it was kind of an impromptu date night with my wife and I. And we pulled back into the garage after seeing the movie Argo, which, by the way, is decent, but not that great. I didn't think it was that great. Ben Affleck is a great director, but not that good of an actor, man. Wow. And I don't know if that's what was perturbing me at all. But we pulled back into the garage, and one of our bikes was kind of in the way. I had parked our scooter kind of cockeyed in the garage, so we kind of my wife was driving, and she kind of had to pull the car in sideways, and I couldn't get out of the passenger side door, and so finally she backed up, and I got out, and she kind of nicked one of the bikes, and I was trying to get this bike out, and it wouldn't come out of the wheel well of the car. And I just went off the rails, and I started yanking this thing out, getting real angry, getting real frustrated. And then I couldn't fit the bike into the space I wanted to put it in. And, I was super, super just terrible. And I just flew off the rails, and you know, my wife kind of stormed off without saying a word to me, and as she so rightly should have, because I was acting like a child. But then today, so we go and we do this they have this like winter fest going on in downtown Seattle at downtown. That's it. That's all you need to know. If you're not from Seattle, it's just downtown in a place. And so we went to this thing, and it turned out that Mairead, my beautiful wife, had put her wallet on top of the car as we were leaving to go downtown. And it fell off the car, of course, on one of the major highways, and is lost to the ages. Luckily, nobody found it. Nobody was stealing money from our bank accounts. We were able to close down the check card and the credit card in time. But I wasn't mad about that. I didn't even get the slightest bit angry about it at all. What's that about? That seems like something that I should have been angry about. But instead, I took all my anger out on a bicycle. That's like some deep-seated, like, childhood, I don't know. Like, something in my past made me really hate bikes. Does that make sense? I just hate bikes. I do, though. I do hate bikes. I don't ride them very often. But when I do, I hate it. I absolutely hate it. I'm just sad. I'm just totally sad. Well, there you go. That's the intro. That's the intro story. Before we get started with this week's episode, episode 127, we're gonna bring Hari Kondabolu in here. This was an interesting conversation because, as you know, when we have comedians on, I like to kind of talk to them about how they got where they're at, because a lot of them are as in my eyes, are successful. Hari is definitely one of those people. And so I kind of wanted to get a feeling for where he was at in his life when he started to hit it big. And, I kind of backtracked a bit after we come back from the second musical break. And he was like, wait a minute. We've talked about all this stuff, and I don't want to talk about this stuff anymore. And rightly so. He explained to me that I could do a Google search and just find out all this information. And it got a little bit awkward there for a moment. But then after the awkward moment passed, of course, we had a great conversation. And the whole episode is just wonderful. I mean, just a splendid person. When we were done recording, he apologized profusely for kind of going off on me there for a little bit. But, listening back to it, it's not that bad, not that bad at all, and he made me steer the conversation in a different direction, which is a wonderful thing, and that's what happens on this show, right? Because it's just two people having a conversation.
But before we do that, we want to remind you guys that we do have an archives page. There are only 20 episodes that are available on iTunes. So if that's the main place that you get the show, or if you get it on Stitcher or anything, there's a ton more episodes. Obviously, this is episode 127. We've got interviews with people like Eddie Pepitone, Bob Saget, Macklemore, Grand Archives, people from the Band of Horses. I mean, just a lot of stuff. John Roderick, all that stuff. Great, great, great shows in the back catalog. So go to www.air-raid.net and click on the archives page, and you can stream each episode from our website there. Also, we'd like to urge you guys to go to iTunes. If you do get this show from Apple, then go to iTunes. Share some love with us, will you? Share some love. Give us a little rating. Star review. Wait a minute. Did I say that backwards? Star rating or a review. That would be great. Tell us how we can improve the show. Tell us what we're doing right. We'd love to hear from you. So there you have it. Okay, we're going to go with our
first musical break. We're going to be featuring music by the Queens of the Stone Age. This song is called Go With The Flow, and we'll be right back with more of the Air Raid Podcast for your ears. Stay with us. Toby Crittenden Studios here in the living room, and joining me here on the this episode 127 of the Air Raid Podcast is Hari Kondabolu.
Hello.
Hello, sir. And I said that right?
You did. I appreciate it. We just
practiced.
and I appreciate the effort. So.
Hey, I try.
Yeah. Most people don't. So it's funny when I go on stage or here at open mics or stuff like when I'm not quite sure who's next, whenever I hear things like, oh, this next name is really hard to, like, all right, let me just go on.
Are you serious? People actually do that?
Yeah, people do that. Or it's like, I'm sorry. And it's like, all right, that's my name now, is I'm sorry, oh God, I'm sorry. I've heard that enough times. So
I wanted to, yeah. I kind of wanted to do this joke.
Yeah.
When you know, I met you out front.
Yeah.
I was like, hey, I really enjoy your video game podcast. Kumail Nanjiani.
Oh, it's Kumail. Yeah. Me and him have gotten confused with each other a number of times. I think there was some video game magazine who talked about a joke of mine that they liked a lot about growing up in Karachi and like how like, because Kumail has a joke about like how he plays. Well, I don't play video games. That's why it's even more.
Yeah,
annoying.
Yeah.
was that one with the it's like wartime and it's Call of Duty.
Call of Duty. Okay. Yeah.
Just like it was the recent Call of Duty game where like he's in Karachi and how he knows all the ins and outs.
Uh huh.
And it quoted me saying it's my joke, which is like the most basic research. Like he is the only well-known Pakistani comic, you know, Pakistani American, you know, he grew up in Pakistan, and I'm like an Indian American comic from New York, so it's just like the most basic research just to see if am I the one who said that joke,
right? Well, your names are not similar,
not at all. It's
and
funny.
You guys don't look anything alike either.
It's funny you say that. So we were we did a show together in New York a bunch of years back, and this bartender came up to me and said, hey, you didn't pay for your rum and diet. And I'm like, well, I don't drink very much. I don't drink before shows ever. Uh-huh. Like, I just, because I've done it maybe once or twice, and I can't handle it. I'm not good at it.
Yeah.
With nerves and alcohol, it just doesn't work. And so I always have water. I'm like, I had a glass of water. It's like, you didn't pay for your, I'm like, I got water. I know I got water. And she got annoyed and confused, stormed out. I saw her then go out the door and then enter the other door on the other side of the room, go make it like a beeline right to Kumail. And I couldn't hear what they were saying, but I saw that her face the way it was with me. And then I'm like, I think I know what's going on here. So I walked over to Kumail. I'm like, did she just ask you, demand that you pay for your rum and diet? And he's like, yes, how did you know? And I'm like, because she just asked me if I would pay for my rum and diet. So
wait, did he got one though, right?
He did.
Okay.
So it was basically, we got confused. And then, you know, I went on stage and I addressed it, you know, talked about that incident. Yeah, people laughed. Yeah. And then Kumail went up a couple of people later and brought me on stage and said, if you'll notice, me and Hari, you know, have different hair. Also, Hari wears glasses. I don't wear glasses. Also, if you notice, we have completely different faces. So, but it happened. You know, I was in San Francisco at the Punchline doing the showcase on Sundays. And I walk outside and I see this comic. I guess he's like an open mic comic. And he's just starting out. And he said, hey, man, I loved your set. And I'm like, yeah, that sounds like bullshit. Because I don't, were you in the room? Because how could you be outside already? Yeah. I just got off stage. And he's like, I'm like, you saw my set? He's like, yeah, I love that joke you do about cheese. I don't have a joke about cheese. Kumail has a joke about cheese. It's a new drug called cheese. I'm like, no, that's a Kumail joke. And that was, there was some satisfaction at a certain time of seeing someone's face turn red. But like at this point, it's just.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. It's just old
it's
news.
It's annoying. It's like we have different features. We look different. We talk about very different things. You know, there's some overlap, but not very much. I mean,
yeah.
We have very different personalities.
Well, Kumail still has kind of a little bit of a of an accent. Still,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. And I'm like, I'm from New York. I'm from Queens. Like, so it's like, what exactly is it that? Yeah, I mean, we don't sound anything alike. So it's clear what it is. not much of a. So, you know, two brown skin comics. You know, it's we're too tall to be Aziz. So it's like, okay, who's left? Right. So.
Oh, man. Well, hey, thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, yeah, man. Absolutely.
I really appreciate you taking the time.
Well, thanks for coming all the way to Toby's house where I'm staying to do this.
I appreciate
the effort.
Well, I work in a city that is close to here. And, I'm going to have to cut that out.
You're not allowed to? Yeah, okay. Sorry about that.
When you work for a government entity, you want to keep that
private, of course.
As private as possible.
Yeah.
So it didn't take me long to get here. And actually I got here early and I wasn't sure that I had the right house and I kept on knocking on the door. I was like, well, maybe he's a late sleeper. Mm-hmm. I know that some comics, you know, if they work at night, they don't get up. He might be sleeping. So I just kept on knocking on the door.
I think that maybe it's the wrong house.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I started thinking that, okay, well maybe he's in there. He just thinks that it's just construction noise. So then I tried to start knocking in different, like patterns that wouldn't be a hammer,
right?
Confused with a hammer, but yeah, you weren't here.
No, I just I spaced on the time. I was on 15th and Republican, and then all of a sudden, my friend Aham was like, "Oh crap, the time."
Yeah. Well. Very interesting story.
Yeah.
you used to reside here in Seattle.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
What brought you out here in the first place? Was it school?
It wasn't school. It was after school. I got a job as an immigrant rights organizer with an organization that was then called Hate Free Zone, that's now known as One America.
Uh-huh.
So it was originally an AmeriCorps position, and then I got, you know, became a full-time job.
Because
my background was in like immigrant rights, civil rights, human rights. Like my interest was in that kind of organizing. So comedy was a thing I did at night because I loved it. I did it through college, and I went to college up in
Maine. Is that when you started
stand up?
In college?
Yeah. I mean, I did it like once in high school. I started a comedy night called Comedy Night when I was a senior, and it was from there. It was like, you know, I thought that was my one time. Then I went up to college in Maine, and it was like, this is nuts because I'm from Queens. This is a bizarre experience to be here.
Yeah.
So then, you know, I kept doing it, and I loved it, and then I thought it would stop forever. And then I moved out to Seattle, and the Seattle comedy scene is very different than the New York scene. The New York scene isn't one scene. It's so huge that, like, there are so many different niches, and
you've got a lot of different, like, comedy, like, communities going on.
A lot of different communities, and also, it's harder in some ways, because you can get, like, on a couple of shows a night, but there's not going to be a guarantee of an audience. And out here, if you get on a show, you're going to have some audience, usually. Uh-huh. And I think the comics also are more supportive, and I think it's also the nature of Seattle. I don't think people are as hardened here as they are in New York. And so when you're trying to develop your voice, to me, it was useful. And, you know, New York, I think you get a little hard when you're on stage. You get a little tougher and you more aggressive. And, you know, I think out here I was able to develop a little more naturally, and it was cool to just have, you know, the Comedy Underground at night. The manager at the time, Carl Warmenhoven, put me up all the time, which was great, and I'd go up on weekends too. And so I moved up really quickly locally, which I would not have in New York. So,
You made a name for yourself.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know,
in a short period of time, which was still surprising.
Yeah, but you were good at it.
Yeah, I was good at it. It was funny because I didn't know I was. I knew I was good, but I didn't think I was, like, pro good. I thought I was good. Like, I'm a college kid who's pretty good. I know how to make people laugh. They're college kids laughing, but that still counts as something. And I knew how to do 45 minutes, even though most of my material at the time was god-awful. It was still, like, I could hold someone's attention for that long. I had enough chops as a performer because I'd done it consistently enough. Not, you know, once every couple of weeks, but enough where I wrote constantly, and my voice was changing and developing. And this city really kind of shaped who I was very much. Like, my first place out of college, really, and going up every night and seeing, you know, professional comics closely do an hour, and, you know, being in a scene where I got ample stage time and could create with others. And, you know, my friend Hamefale Jayoluo is a brilliant writer and musician, and, you know, we met at an open mic and we would write together, and so I had all these things that would that would lead me to be a stronger comic, and I wouldn't have had those as quickly in New York. So I mean, I came out here to work, so I'm still a bit surprised that this thing took off,
you know? So, like, when you started hitting up open mics and stuff, I mean, you're still holding down a day job at that point too?
Did that
kind of get hard?
No, not at all. I mean, because the day job, you know, because my job was, it was a hard job. Like, I was organizing, I was working with refugees.
Well, that's what it sounds like. It's very, very
serious,
involved.
Yeah, it was, you know, and long hours, and I'd miss a few shows, you know, if I had to, and which is fine because I wasn't here for comedy, you know. But the comedy was such a relief at the end of the day, you know, because I was so stressed. And, you know, you're talking about families being torn apart and, like, people who are, you know, refugee stories are generally very hard. They're not easy to hear, and they're very sad. And you're trying to be the best support you can be, but at the same time, you know what your restrictions are. And, you know, I would go to comedy at night, and I would need it. I would need it to...
Right. You'd need to laugh.
I'd need to laugh, and I'd need to create, and I'd like to make others laugh. And it was definitely therapeutic. And, you know, some of the stuff I did as an immigrant rights organizer fed into my comedy. And certainly, like, I wouldn't necessarily share specific stories, but, like, my politics were getting shaped while it was happening. And, you know, it was an incredible... My time in Seattle is still... Those 2 years are, like, the two most important years of my career so far, without a doubt.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Let's go back a little bit.
Yeah.
What was it like the first time? Do you remember your first experience, like, getting up on stage?
Yeah, it was doing stand-up. It was in high school.
Yeah.
I was 17. It was January 14th, 2000. It was a comedy night that I had created, and I was the last act. I did a half an hour. My heart was racing.
Mm-hmm.
People laughed, which felt amazing. I knew I was hooked.
Where were you doing this at?
It was at my high school, Townsend Harris High School, in our auditorium. And we had a full house, every seat, and people standing, and it was because our school was kind of a nerd school, and people didn't do anything other than try to, you know, do whatever it took to get into college. So
right,
the idea of this would help for college, and this didn't, this wasn't a thing that you necessarily assumed would get you into a good school. So why would you do it?
Right.
But I really wanted to do this more than anything because I loved comedy, and I felt I was funny, and I wrote a lot, and I thought I could. This is something I had to try, and I mean, I kind of knew. I mean, you don't completely know, but the first time I did it, I knew like I was hooked.
Yeah, yeah.
It's
gotta
hard
do that again.
I mean, it's hard to get off it. Like once you're like used to that feeling of like people laughing and cheering and you know that you said something just the right way. I mean, that's still an incredible feeling, and I still get a chill when it happens.
Yeah,
and it's been 13 years now. So
wow,
yeah,
that's pretty good, man.
Yeah.
You said you went to a pretty affluent school.
It was a public high school.
Public high school.
Yeah,
but everybody was kind of, the end goal was definitely to get into a good college.
Yeah,
there were no like.
It was the best high school in Queens, public high school.
Yeah,
they took like the kids with the highest GPAs in middle school, which seems ridiculous when you think about it, just because you're so young when they're judging you. But you know, it wasn't. We weren't a rich school. You know, we had public high school money, but these were all kids who it was like a magnet type school.
Right.
So.
Right. So was that kind of like when you were getting further and further into comedy?
Yeah.
Was it because I'm getting that maybe your parents like were more educated and wanted you to go into kind of a,
that's true of most comics, I think.
Highly educated thing.
I mean,
then,
both my folks were, they have like advanced degrees, as as do I. Doing comedy in high school was never an issue. Me doing comedy in college wasn't an issue, because my grades were fine. If anything, my grades slipped because I was in love with a girl my junior year of high school, but I don't think that, they didn't know that, but that had nothing to do with comedy. Because the thing is, I didn't just jump into comedy. Comedy kind of found me. So I have an unconventional.
It was a slow creep.
Yeah, it was kind of like I was doing other things. And even after, I got discovered by the HBO Comedy Festival, after I was on Jimmy Kimmel Live, I also got into the London School of Economics because they had a human rights program. The same week, actually, that I got all that news, I found out about LSE.
Wow.
And, I got a manager for comedy, and I ended up taking the year off and getting my master's. So every decision that I've made is still like very intentional and slow and deliberate. And I didn't want to just jump into a comedy career. I wasn't sure, even though I had all the machinery for a comedy career at that point, which was happened within months. It's not to all of a sudden you're in Seattle, you're doing these random rooms all over the city too. I have a manager and all this other stuff, a TV credit and festival appearance. Like, I didn't want to just jump into a career in comedy because I didn't know what that was, and I didn't plan for that. I planned to be an organizer, and I planned to get my master's in human rights so I'd have a human rights framework for, like, this organizing work. The idea of going into stand-up comedy and traveling the country, like, I didn't think that was realistic. And
well, because it's not really.
It's
right?
hard to imagine. It's hard to imagine doing it. And the thing is, once I got that TV credit, I think I kind of assumed to some degree that, things would just happen. And, you realize really quickly, it's a one-time payment. It's not a guarantee of health insurance.
Yeah.
It's not, it doesn't.
This isn't Canada.
Right, right.
Come on.
It does. Well, I mean, it doesn't lead to, there's nothing concrete about being on TV once, which I think when you're doing comedy in your scene, the idea of being on television is the biggest thing in the world. But when you actually do it, you realize it's neat, it's cool, you're established kind of, but it doesn't mean anything in terms of your actual practical life. So
right.
I mean, when I was
what were your parents saying at that point too? Were they kind of trying to push you into being an educated person, or
no?
Did being a comedian kind of scare them at
my,
all?
My parents have been nothing but supportive.
Really?
My parents have been nothing but supportive. Yeah, there's been because like I was saying, I made very deliberate and very deliberate choices. I mean, this stuff happened naturally without me trying to be on television. I got discovered in Seattle by the HBO Comedy Festival because, like, the guy who was booking it, you know, now a friend, JP Buck, had seen a video of me on the internet because I was playing Bummer Shoot that year in the local stage.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So he had seen clips online on my website, asked me for demos. I sent them more demos. Next thing I know, I got into the festival. I auditioned in San Francisco and L.A. for the first time. I'd never been to those cities before.
Right.
Went down there, got it. Kimmel wanted to have me on because, like, you know, I was doing this festival. I'd never been on TV. So, you know, they had a
count. How, what's the time frame of all this?
This all happened within a week, man. Like, I got.
Are you serious?
Like, I got discovered probably the previous, like, September or something, like, or August or something. No, it was probably July or August where I got asked to send in tapes.
Wow.
Started sending in tapes. Well, then all of a sudden, the next, like, February. Let's see, when did I find out? Yeah, that sounds about right. Around February or so, I found out about Kimmel, the festival, and LSE in the same week.
Wow.
So, you know, so for my folks, it wasn't like I was seriously pursuing comedy.
Yeah.
They knew I loved to do it, so it wasn't like I'm like, hey, I'm dropping everything.
Uh-huh.
And even after I had this career, like I was saying, like I went to London to get my master's, and I finished my degree.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
They knew two things. They knew I had an education behind me. I made very slow, deliberate decisions. And I wasn't going into comedy, like, naked. I had a TV credit, a manager, festival appearance. I had things that showed I was legitimate.
Yeah.
Which is strange because I wasn't trying.
You know what you are?
What?
You're the liberal Ben Stein.
How's that?
Yeah, isn't he an economist?
No, my background's in human rights, so I'm not an economist.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah.
But what was the London School of Economics?
I got a human rights master's program.
It's
law,
gotcha.
And sociology. The complete name is the London School of Economics and Social Science.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Political science.
Well, that joke fell flat. See, that's why I'm not a comedian.
You can edit. You can edit. But, like, yeah, I mean, so my folks, and even now, they're incredibly supportive. I don't think my mom is necessarily impressed. She's supportive, but she was, you know, she was a doctor. You know, she was a doctor as a woman in southern India in the late 70s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's an incredible feat, especially at that time.
Yeah.
So if she was that, and I'm like a comic, you know, like there's something to that. Like, and she's proud.
Yeah,
it's not
that
she's not proud, but, like, one, you know, this isn't, let's be realistic, this isn't the hardest thing in the world. You know, I'm good at it, but it's not like, you know, I'm not a doctor. That's still fucking incredible,
right?
But you know, she's proud. But you know, it's not like, oh my god, you know?
Yeah,
she's,
yeah.
You know, my mom's really even keeled about it.
Was there any part of you that's that tries to kind of impress them?
I mean, just like any other kid.
Yeah.
Nothing like, you know. I want them to enjoy what I do, and I ask them what they think. And but you know, it's they're really like, my folks are like. I'm amazed by them, just about how they've adjusted to this, and it hasn't been that weird for them. You know, and my brother too. My brother, you know, was in a successful band, and so, like,
both that just broke up.
Too,
right?
And so
Das Racist.
And so, I mean, the fact that we've done these unconventional things. I mean, they.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know too many parents, especially, like, you know, immigrant parents who are, you know, they're not from this country, they might have had a different set of expectations, who have been able to adjust so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so much love. And, you know, I'm very fortunate because, you know, I know other folks who, their parents, it was harder for them to get around, you know,
right.
to come around. And my parents were not that. My mom has always been extremely cool. Like, my mom has always been really thoughtful and ahead of her time. So I made really practical decisions, and I always talked through my decisions with them, and I told them that, you know, I want to give this a try. I'm giving myself 3 years, and we'll see how it goes after 3 years. And 3 years, it went well. And, like, all right, 3 more years. And, you know, that's I've been very, yeah, they've been great.
Good. Well, hey, let's do this. Let's take a musical break, and then we'll come back and have more with Hari
Kondabolu.
All right, stay with us. Keep on playing. All right, we are back, coming to you live from, well, not quite live, pre-recorded from Crittenden Studios here in the Central District in beautiful Seattle, Washington. And welcome back, Hurry.
Hello.
So when we left for that musical break, we were kind of talking about how you got started in comedy and how your family felt about it. Your family sounds awesome.
Yeah,
they're very supportive.
They're doing great.
Yeah. So, and you were you talked a little bit about this week that you had where basically you had played Bumbershoot. HBO saw that.
No. And then so what happened was I was on the Bumbershoot
the roster.
I was on the roster.
Yeah.
And the head of talent, I guess, at the HBO Comedy Festival saw my name on the site. Had never heard of me before. Went to my website, saw the clips. And then we started a process of submitting tapes and going back and forth.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And so and then Kimmel saw the HBO thing?
No.
Oh,
man,
no.
Man, we went over this.
Did we?
Jesus
Christ. I thought you said he watched the
same things two or three times over the course of this interview. We've basically talked about two things that we've repeated twice. No. This is all biographical. None of this is particularly interesting. This is all Googleable, dude. Like, all this, you can just Google my name. I've done this interview, like, about three or four times on the internet. You can find a version of it. It's not all that interesting anymore. Ask me about...
I wanted to see how that was, how you felt about that.
I mean...
Like, I just wanted to bring it back really quick and say,
sure.
Like, what's going on in your mind at this point? Like, are you freaking out? Because you seem like a very even-keel person. Like,
I can be. I mean, I think that week was kind of a strange week because I had not planned a comedy career.
Yeah.
I was there for a reason, and I think I was surprised by all that, and I felt like I had a choice to make. And I didn't have to make it in that moment, but I knew there was a choice that was
right, right. Something was coming.
Yeah, it was unbelievable for somebody out of Seattle to get all this stuff. And the other comics that I performed with didn't know about any of this. I didn't tell them I was auditioning. I didn't want to tell them. I'm like, it just, because it made me feel like I stuck out in a way I didn't want. Like, we were all part of a scene and we were developing a scene. So it was weird to be like, and this kid from New York who showed up 2 years ago is getting this stuff. And when I did eventually tell them, to be honest, they were incredibly supportive.
Yeah, yeah.
They all watched the Kimmel set together at I think at the Canterbury, and you know, were excited to me, and I got a lot, excited for me, and I got a lot of texts from people who were saying that, you know, they're proud that I represented the city and how much I meant to them, and how I'm not from Seattle, but tonight I am. And
yeah, yeah.
And you know, it's beautiful kind of sentiments. So.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sorry I got snappish. It was just I think after a while, like, you know, I've done enough interviews where, like, biographical details, like the early part of this interview, like, it could have been, you know, from another thing. And it's no offense to you.
Yeah.
It's just that if you...
Well, see, I don't do... Here's the thing.
It's like,
I think
it's personal stories. After
right,
all, this,
right.
The stories are going to be the same. So it's going to be a repetition of the same thing. So it's just like when I have to repeat details, it's like, man, I'm sick of repeating the same details about this miraculous journey where I, you know, tell jokes in the basement.
Yeah, so. and I can totally understand that.
So, but I think it was just like, I'm repeating it again.
No, I can understand that. And here's my problem is that I don't do any research.
The problem is I'm unprepared for this.
Yeah, yeah.
So
you should hear my Charles R. Cross interview.
All right.
Yeah, yeah.
But
no, I always get in. And here's one thing too. And I was nervous about meeting you.
Yeah.
And talking with you because I realized that you're a very educated person. Like we had, I mentioned Charles R. Cross. I've mentioned this a couple times on the show because, like, I was super nervous to meet that guy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he's an author. He's very well respected in the Seattle community. You know, and like, you know, just talking to somebody like that whose brain is like a wealth of information. Like, you really got to tiptoe around getting something wrong. Or if you miss something during the conversation, like, and he already told you, which
present
company.
Well, it's just like to me, this is, you know, my story is...
Well, it's not interesting to you, right?
Because
you lived it.
Well, it's not that I've lived it. I've repeated it so many times.
Yeah,
so
yeah, okay.
it's more about, like, you know, it's to me, it's interesting. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
You know, like, I the bait, it's like... well, he came for this thing, but this other thing happened. And whoa, he's at a crossroads. And then he made a choice. But whoa, he came from this background. You know, it's like, you know, and I'm sure, I'm not saying, you know, I'm bad-mouthing myself, but like, you know, it's interesting and all, but, you know, after a while, it's like, yeah. Right now, this is far more interesting for me to deconstruct previous interviews of telling the same story. And look, it is a fine story. It's not like rags to riches, but it's like, oh, okay, human being, things happen, and you make choices, and it's an unconventional way to get to comedy, you know. And my parents are supportive, and that's a unique thing too, because it's like, you know, a lot of South Asian parents, you know, with a different set of expectations and educated, you know, that they could be thrown off. And my folks are real cool, and they've been great about it. So it's like, but you know, I'm a little like, I've done this. I know you're not the same person. I know this isn't the same podcast, but to me, until this moment right now, it has been the same podcast, even though this could have been podcast X this moment right now. Now it's
well,
like,
that hurts me, man.
No, but
that hurts my feelings.
Well, it's just, I don't care.
Are you, but, do you not have a heart?
It's not you. It's like, it's, you know, because at a certain point, if you get asked the exact same question, you're just like, this is going to be the same answer.
So
right now, this is fun for me because it's like, I'm telling you what previous interviews are like. And that's fun because I've never done that before.
Yeah.
This is now a unique thing. This is now a thing that exists that, you know, didn't exist. And everything else is kind of like, the same things over and over again, same questions over and over again.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I did a thing in New York called Beginnings, which are all about my beginnings, which is this.
Right.
You know, I've done, whenever I do a South Asian podcast, it's always about my parents. And
what
like,
do you mean, South Asian podcast?
Like something that's South Asian centric.
Okay.
So,
I guess there's a show out there for everything, right?
Well, there's a lot of South Asians. I'm South Asian. You know, South Asian means, you know, South Asian means it's like India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, right?
Yeah,
so the
totally.
Subcontinent. So, you know, there's folks who, you know, are, you know, from the community and or young people like me who like grew up here, who, you know, there's a whole culture of people of podcasts around. You know, I'm definitely like, I'm a unique figure in that world and a proud, you know, South Asian. So like, you know, I've done that part of it about like what do my parents think. So it's kind of like, okay, all right.
why don't you have your own podcast in a sea of like comedian podcasters?
I've been thinking about that, man. You know,
have you been thinking about creating your own?
I love my.
You obviously have an opinion, asshole.
Right. Well, my friend Jay Smooth, who's an incredible video blogger. He has a video blog called The Ill Doctor.
I've heard that name before.
He's great. He's probably, I think, the best in that particular genre.
Okay.
Fantastic.
And, what kind of thing is it?
It's it's primarily, you know, because he had the first he has the longest running hip hop radio show, and he's had a hip hop website, and so, you know, a lot of it is about hip hop, but it's also about pop culture, and it's become more about actually pop culture, politics, and media analysis. Very funny. And I think it's something about that format of the video essay that he does really well. He edits well, and because he's funny, like he can carry.
Wait, is that
people.
The guy from Curb Your Enthusiasm?
Who's JB Smooth?
JB Smooth.
Yeah, that's a different guy.
Oh, okay.
He's a comic. Jay Smooth is a radio DJ from New York.
Okay, gotcha.
So I was thinking about doing it with him, and we were talking about it for a bit. And then me and my brother, you know, now have talked about maybe doing a podcast together. So I think that's the goal for the new year.
I think you should, man.
It would be fun. And, you know, it's such a, you know, it's nice that, for example, with Marc Maron, it's been wonderful to see Marc Maron's podcast. When you don't need to deal with an audience's immediate expectations, you can just go. You can talk about whatever you want to talk about. You can be as loose as you want. You can go on tangents. You can edit it later if you want to.
Yeah.
And that's great. And also what I think it's done for him as a performer is that he has a lot of people that come specifically to see him and who are single ticket buyers, meaning they're not there with a date. They're there to see him, and they don't care if anyone comes or not because they're connected to him. And it also means that you have a base that has a longer attention span because they've listened to you in this format. So, I mean, from both like a practical standpoint as well as creatively, I'm sure like he's coming up with ideas constantly doing it. And I think that's a, you know, that's
a large part of it too is just like, I mean, he's dealing with shit.
Yes.
You know, like, and I think that's what really grabbed people.
Yeah.
In the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, is to hear somebody who's well spoken, who's dealing with regular human problems.
Oh yeah, and
you know, and like, and that's why I found it so interesting. And you know, as time goes on, you get tired of hearing stuff like that. I don't know. I've kind of dropped off the WTF bandwagon a little bit.
I mean, I've never listened.
It's still a great show.
I've never listened religiously to any podcast. Even yeah, it's a WTF. I've only listened to a handful, but maybe that's good. But like, I really love, you know. I mean, just even the way he approaches different interviews,
mm-hmm.
like
mm-hmm.
whether it was the Mencia one or the Louis C.K. one was incredible.
Have you been on that show?
I was on a live one in Portland, but it was during the earlier days, yeah. So like episode 68 or 9. Or it was early.
Did he ask you about your beginnings?
Very, very. And we talked mostly about like our like relationship because uh-huh. I
was it heated
a little bit.
Was
yeah,
it?
Yeah, because he it was funny because he had you know he had described me I think on some podcast as the brown version of him or the Indian version of him and. And it was very, you know, it was irritating.
Yeah, because
he's one of my heroes and certainly an influence. But it was like come on, like that's it's not the same thing. We do different things. Certainly, he's an influence. Definitely.
Yeah.
So you know, we kind of, you know, just how condescending that compliment is, and he's giving himself a compliment at the same time. and so you know, and it was fun to do live, and he was gracious enough to you know, because honestly, if he you know, I was kind of going after him, and if he wanted to make it stop, he could have. And mm-hmm, I think he liked the fact it was working, and that you know, it was a funny exchange.
Yeah, so, yeah.
And he was kind enough to let me do it, but
yeah. Well, how is it being in front of you guys do this all the time as comics, but yeah. Like being up there in a podcast like forum,
yeah,
and like talking about like super personal stuff. Does that? I don't know. Is that a hard thing to do?
It can be. I mean, I haven't done a live one
yeah.
that was super personally. I just did Pete Holmes' podcast.
Yeah.
Totally. And I mean, that wasn't super personal. I mean, he usually likes that. You know, we talked a little bit about religion, mm-hmm. which is hard only because, you know, when I wasn't the first comic up there, so there was already comics up there, and comics, you know, they like to interrupt and riff. So it's like you can't get into a real conversation at that point.
Right. This was a live one as well?
Oh, it was a live one, yeah.
Oh, okay.
I mean, you know, I've had some pretty good ones just with, like I did Baron Vaughn's podcast, Deep Shit, and I thought that was great. Just, you know, because Baron and I were friends, and, you know, we talked a lot about just being honest on stage and what truth is, and like that was wonderful, and that's something I grapple with constantly when I'm writing. So
yeah,
you know, it's different, but at the same time, I think my favorite comics are the ones that do have that depth, that do like are able to engage in that conversation. You know, they're not writing blindly; they're thinking about these things, and that's why they're great, and that's why their jokes aren't just jokes, but they have some substance behind them. Uh-huh. Right? So,
well, I would say you do that pretty well.
I mean, I hope to.
The stand-up that I've seen of yours is very political.
Yeah,
for one,
yeah.
Would you say that most of your comedy is political?
It's funny because I it's hard. I guess so. I mean, it's hard to. I see it more as social, to be perfectly honest. I mean,
yeah.
I think they all have political stuff to them because I'm like a politically minded person.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I don't talk about politics in the sense of like Republicans, Democrats, that stuff very much. I do a little, but I'm not all that interested.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more interested in like the bigger issues like homophobia, racism. So it's political in the sense
of
how it affects societal
things. Okay.
And so that's kind of where, you know, I'm focused. I mean, I guess I'm broadly political in that like I like to press those buttons and
uh-huh.
You know, and it's weird because to me, the personal is political. Like the choices that we make are political choices. Whatever it is whatever choice we're making for anything has some impact on the world. So for me, since I don't separate them, to me it's like the same thing on stage. And
right.
And I want to be. And that's one thing. Like I feel like I want to be. I like my jokes and I like how I make the points I make. I want to be more personal on stage. I feel like it's the one thing that I've been missing. Like you get a sense of who I am on based on what I'm saying,
right,
and my views, but I wish.
But isn't that a change of style, though? That's like a, that seems like a whole change of style.
There's ways to integrate both. It's hard, but I feel like there's, I mean, I think Marin does it extremely well. I mean, I've seen Marin talk about his life and his views and his evolving views, and at the same time,
right,
you
know,
you get a sense of who he is and what he believes, and he's, you know, he makes political statements too, not as much as he did at a certain point in his career. But I definitely do think that's possible. I also like to play with the form a lot. Like my favorite comic is a British comic named Stuart Lee, and I think he's a guy. I mean, he's a little less personal. He does have some. He, I think, is more of a model for me in terms of, like, he does have some personal stories. He doesn't get too deep, but deep enough where you know about his health conditions and family and stuff.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And he weaves in other stuff that also has his politics and. He very much plays with the form. Like, you know, his last special that I saw had maybe 6 jokes in over an hour and a half spread out, and they're very tightly worded, and they come around at the end. So I love that. I love playing with the form.
Yeah. Is it working so far? I mean, have you been integrating some of these changes into your act?
Last week, we talked earlier just about how I come to Seattle to work out new material, and I think I started to this time around more than ever. And I felt good about that. And, you know, I don't usually, you know, talking about sex, for example, is like a newer idea for me. Like, I just never did it. Like, I never talked about those things. I'm like, it's my life. And then it's like, I'm starting to a little bit more and talking about relationships a little bit more. And,
well, it's like a comfort level thing, too, right?
It's like, you know, a lot of us,
me talking about sex with my parents, I can't do it.
And it's a weird thing, because when you're performing on stage and when you're, you know, eventually you might think my folks might hear it.
Right.
In a weird way, you are telling them, right?
Yeah.
And so that things like that are uncomfortable. But like, I feel like the best comics push, and it's not just pushing hard points, but they're pushing themselves. And I mean, again, that's another reason why I love Seattle, because I feel more comfortable. Like, I did a thing at Town Hall earlier in the year. I don't remember when. Maybe the spring. I think, it was the spring. And this thing called Scratch Night. That
Totally.
I helped develop out there.
Did Derek Sheen do that one, too?
I think, he did. He did the next one, I think.
Oh, okay.
I did the first one, and it was wonderful. And I went up, and I did some stand-up, and I told stories I'd never told before, some of them that weren't even fully written, just kind of coming from an honest place. And it was one of the most rewarding experiences I've ever had as a performer. And I can't imagine doing that in another place. And here I feel that the audience trusts me, but, you know, they might not know this, but I also trust them. I trust them on a level I don't trust most most audiences. I feel like I can put myself out there and they will listen to me and they won't interrupt. And I might do something weird or unconventional and they'll be willing to see where it goes. And that takes a lot of faith for me in an audience, because, you know, stand-up audiences, especially at clubs, it's like, joke, what's taken so long, you know?
And, yeah, yeah.
You know, to move from that to a longer form, you know, that's hard.
So, right, yeah. Yeah, and sometimes it's not going to work on certain audiences, too, you know?
Yeah, no, totally. Yeah. And I understand it, too. Like, Stuart Lee has talked about this as well, but, like, you know, he talks about how he, as he's gotten older, he understands how his shows aren't for everybody, and he sympathizes when people are upset at what they're seeing, because it's like, because he has a kid now, and he's like, you got to get a sitter, and you can have a night out, and then you see something you don't even see as comedy. And and I felt bad, because over the weekend there was this guy, and the other comics were telling me he was upstairs, and his wife was, you know, he was with his wife, and he was saying, you know, she brought me out because I wanted to laugh. You know, I'm working 60-hour days for 7 days a week for months, and I'm here to laugh. And he left in the middle of my set because he just didn't like it in the slightest.
Right.
And so on one
was he complaining? Was he trying to get his money back or something?
No,
or
he just left. He just left. Okay. He was just like, what the hell? You know, like, because this is the to him, I was the furthest thing possible from comedy.
Right, right.
And I understand that. I am not for everybody. And I feel bad because it's like, dude, like, this is why Google exists. You know, this is why you can make more thoughtful choices in how you want to spend your money.
Right,
like, your entertainment choices aren't at the will of a club booker anymore, really.
Yeah, yeah.
You can actually do the research.
Well, it sounds like and I would get along very well. we just don't.
Don't do the research. You just go.
You just do it, man. You just do it. And then we're just pissed off about it later. Right. Yeah. So when you're doing stuff for I've seen the show that
totally
you're on.
Biased.
Totally biased. Totally biased. Yes. With
W. Kamau Bell.
Yeah. When you're doing stuff like that, do you find that kind of helps you along with your end goal here too? Because that's more of like you're writing those what would you call them, commentaries?
Yeah, I mean, right? You mean with when I'm on the show? Or
yeah,
whatever?
Yeah. Do you actually write for the show too?
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm a writer on the show. Gotcha. But I also I'm a writer primarily, but like they also put me up. When there's something they feel I could cover better, mm-hmm. Or have a specific take on that would be fine. Right. So, it's definitely helped in some ways with my stand-up, just in terms of, you're staying sharp. I think as a stand-up, some of us are disciplined writers. And mm-hmm. Until now, I've never been a disciplined writer. I go through bursts of creativity. Mm-hmm. Middle of the night, all of a sudden, I'm just writing frantically. And this is the first time I've had to sit down and write every day because it's my job.
Well, and write for somebody else too, right? That's got to be a hard thing to do, right?
Yes, very much so. I mean, it's definitely easier in that we're friends. And we've been friends for years. So when I got the thing, it's he's closer to my voice than a lot of people. But still, it's an adjustment because it's also, mm-hmm. It's not stand-up. I'm not writing stand-up for him. Not to say that I could do that better, but like I certainly like... Writing for TV is also, you're writing shorter and it has to be punchier and it's a different kind of thing. And, you're restricted by time and content to some degree because it's television.
Yeah.
It's a different thing in the sense that it's not the style that I do on stage for myself. It's a different person in a different format. Uh-huh. But the constantly having to write is making me think more. And every now and then you come up with a thought. I'm like, this doesn't work for the show, but this works for me.
Right,
is a thought that like couldn't go anywhere else. And that's because I'm constantly reading. I'm constantly writing. And before, it's like, you read things and something pops into your head. Now they have to pop into my head because we need it for the show.
Right.
I push myself more. And plus I have like people to hang out with who are comedians who are extremely funny. And we'll riff and we'll go back and forth. And, we'll riff out something that's like, oh, this is a joke. We can come out and say this. Or Dwayne Kennedy. Dwayne can say this. Dwayne's another writer on the show. Like he can go on there and be a guest. And it certainly has made me work harder than I ever have in comedy.
And learn how to do that in a group too, huh?
Which is fun. And it's hard. You're pumping out a thing every week, and also the Daily Show and Colbert are on. And when they're on the same time we were on, it's kind of like, okay, what have they covered that we can't use?
Right,
because they're on every day. We're on once a week, so mm-hmm. we're basically cutting a bunch of stuff. But at the end of the day, that's probably good because that makes ours even more unique.
Yeah. You can play off the other ones.
Right. Like this has gone. So what's our unique take that they can't do?
Right. So what are the ratings like?
They've been pretty good, man. Yeah. I mean,
steadily seeing an increase.
This is certainly it's interesting, especially in the young women from 18 to 30 something. Like that demographic has gone up a lot, and I think part of it is that we have a lot of women on the air who do segments like Aparna Nancherla and Janine Brito, who are both writers, and we've had a lot of female guests, and Kamau is a man. He's a feminist dude. How many feminist dudes from San Francisco are on TV, and so he's talking. He talks about women's rights issues, and we had a segment on catcalling where we did a man on the street where we interviewed women about their experiences, and that's never really been done. And also from the perspective of a man talking about, this is wrong, dudes, stop catcalling women, leave them alone. Like, they don't like it, and getting and that's another thing, by the way, that I'm proud of about our show is that we have these, on the street segments, these remotes where we ask New Yorkers what they think about things. And New Yorkers are so opinionated and so funny. And they all think they can be comics, and a lot of them could be. So funny.
Just from the experience of walking down the sidewalk every day.
Random person. Yeah, because you have enough to talk about. You've seen enough things. And New York is also, you're exposed to so many things.
Yeah.
And so people are just very, very funny. And that's the defense mechanism of the city, maybe. I mean, you'll have to find a way to cope with it, so you you need it.
Right, right. But just being one of the crowd.
Right, right. So many people. Oh my God, just dealing. Life is so much harder there, to be honest, than Seattle, for sure.
See, I've never been to New York. I always tell myself that I'm going to go.
It's so different.
I need to.
It's so different. I mean, I suppose it's all cities are cities in certain ways, you know.
Right.
Right. Compared to a more rural setting, it's, you know, but comparatively, like as a city, like Seattle is so much more comfortable. Yeah. I mean, that's why I think there's so much complacency. I think why people like don't always accomplish what they want, and they kind of settle down and settle into place because they're happy because they have, my personal life is secure and I have a nice job and, you know, live in a decent house. And, you know, when you have those things, like, why would I keep pushing?
Right, right.
You know, and there's something envious about that, isn't it? You know, like I come back here and I'm like, my career is going fine, but like, man, this is comfortable. I come back here 4 or 5 times a year just because I'm like at peace here.
It feels like home, huh?
It feels like home. It's fresh air and it's like, food is more, you know, Seattle's still expensive, but, you know, because the city, it's a big city, but compared to New York, this is sweet. Yeah. And I grew up in New York.
So I've heard.
Yeah.
So I've heard. Yeah. Well, hey, man, thank you so much
for
talking with me. I really appreciate it. I had a great time
chatting
with you.
Thank you very much.
And hopefully we can do this again. And next time I will look you up on Google before we do that.
That sounds great. Thanks, man.
All right. Have a good night.